Once a country in the north and a country in the south has made some pledges and emission cut promise, the north can allow itself to pollute more than its promise if in return it pays another country, say in the south, for the possibility to cut back emissions there.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Policies and commitments to prevent climate change and destruction of the environment emerge from global meetings and conferences. But what does economics teach us about making and sticking to those international commitments? Our latest episode examining the policy implications of the topics discussed in the BRED IGC virtual PhD course on environmental economics is focusing on international climate action. And Bård Harstad of Stanford joins me now. Bård, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you so much, Tim.
It's never been more important. It's never been more urgent for us to have international climate action. But what are the obstacles to achieving that?
So there are several obstacles, clearly. So basically, by international agreement of any sort, we are trying to motivate and persuade countries to do something what they would not have done unilaterally without this encouragement. For example, we would like them to make deeper cuts than what they would find it to be rational individually or nationally. And we are trying to motivate them to comply to those pledges or commitments, even if there is, for example, a recession at home or an election to worry about. And that is the challenges. So some of them can be collectively defined as free riding problems. And to motivate countries to comply and participate and contribute despite these incentives to free ride, we have to both motivate them to join the coalition or the agreement in the first place, and then also to comply with those promises that they made at the bargaining table later on.
There is no alternative but to make these agreements. How can we overcome these obstacles? Because from the outside, they seem pretty intractable.
Yes, they are. And if we study the incentives to participate in an agreement or a coalition, we see that in many cases, the free riding incentives is so large that the coalition ends up being rather small. We have seen this for many other environmental problems, but for when it comes to climate change, I think that we don't have too many examples. The first example was the Kyoto Protocol from the 1997.
We'll recommend the adoption of this protocol to the conference by unanimity.
Many countries signed the protocol, but in the end, only 37 countries had to do emission cuts. It was mainly Europe and a few other countries. So the incentive to not participate was then large. What we did in the Paris Agreement was a much more bigger agreement. We succeeded in motivating every country to sign the agreement.
Thanks to the distinguished climate leaders assembled here today who are ready to take action.
One of the things we did was that we were more flexible, or the UN were more flexible regarding what or who could decide on the nationally determined contribution. By allowing the countries to have more discretion about that, it became less costly to participate.
Let's dig into that a little bit, because yes, the two what seemed like breakthroughs that people will remember in climate negotiations were Kyoto 97, Paris 2015. You're saying that the design of how the negotiations were structured made Kyoto disappointing afterwards?
Well, I think that there might be a trade-off, right? Because the trade-off might be that, on the one hand, in the Paris Agreement, we succeeded to motivate all countries in the world to participate. That was not the case for the Kyoto, at least not when it comes to emission cuts. But the trade-off is that maybe the level of ambition is not sufficiently deep in the Paris Agreement. And that is a typical trade-off that we face in international cooperation. We can have a wide and broad coalition, or a narrow and perhaps with deeper cuts. The difference in bargaining that you refer to is that in the Paris Agreement, in contrast to Kyoto Protocol and in contrast to trade negotiations, where there is a lot of peer pressure and conditionality built into the pledges that are made, In the Paris Agreement, the structure is that each country is self-deciding on their nationally determined contribution, which it submits to the UN, and it can update them over time, but it's less conditionality built into the negotiation process, which from an economist point of view seems a bit surprising, because if you are a different country than me, if your emission cut is not conditioned on what I will do, then it seems like I should have a rather strong incentive to just do what I want anyway.
Yes, for large economies which have electorates that are unsympathetic to the sorts of cuts that might be optimal, politicians that might be unsympathetic to it, there seems to be very little incentive not to free ride.
Right. So this pledge and review process, which it is called in the Paris Agreement, has been criticized for all the amount of discretion that it gives to the countries themselves. So in parts of my research, I've tried to figure out whether it makes sense at all from a game theoretical perspective and whether we can expect countries to contribute more.
Mm-hmm.
And I embarked on this research because when I was teaching environmental economics, I had to say something about the Paris Agreement, about the pledge and the review procedure, and why it was different from Kyoto, and whether it could make sense at all. And one possible answer is that, after all, there is a lot of uncertainty in the bargaining process and in the decision-making process. And I would like your offers to be good, and not only that, but I would like, if the offers are better than the business-as-usual situation, I would like this package of offers to be accepted. And one possible worry is that if the countries are not submitting sufficiently attractive pledges,
mm-hmm.
then maybe countries will not accept the package, the bundle of all these offers. So if I'm uncertain about what exactly the other countries are willing to accept before they leave the table and things could break down, then that can itself motivate me to promise or pledge an emission cut that is more than what I would have done unilaterally.
Why are those countries worried that their package might not be accepted?
Well, they may or may not be, but if the set of packages from the other countries is better than the business as usual, in the sense that they are collectively, that UK or Asia, US, other countries are making a set of emission cuts that I would rather see implemented instead of that package being rejected and so that we are going back to the business as usual, then I see that I hope that we succeed with this package instead of going back to business as usual. And if I think that possibility or that probability be raised if I make a more attractive offer, that can motivate me to do it.
This, you believe, has a better chance of success than the kind of top-down mandate that was the case in Kyoto, where, as you say, many people signed up to it, but not many people implemented it.
That's a good question. So here we get back to the trade-off. Because on the one hand, if I'm sitting here and bargaining with you, I would rather prefer that you are making a more ambitious offer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have this top-down approach, which is sometimes called, or if I can say that I will make deeper cuts if you make a deeper cut, then if that procedure, this top-down or traditional bargaining process, leads us to make deeper cuts, we are better off. The problem with that is that the incentives to free ride in the first place might be too large, so that we end up with a rather small coalition which are making these deeper cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So the success of the Paris Agreement was that by allowing this pledge and review procedure and nationally determined contribution, it became less expensive for countries to opt in, to participate. Because after all, they could more or less propose what they wanted. So that reduction in cost can be seen as one of the reasons why the coalition is much larger or included every country in the Paris Agreement. And that, of course, is the claim to success.
Does it make a difference the relative power of the individuals that are making offers within this negotiation?
I think it used to matter a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
So in typical bargaining situation, the size and economic power and even the power in other measures by how much it trades, that can matter a lot. Because if such a huge country like US is putting pressure on other countries, then that will have a bigger clout than if a small country is placing this pressure. I think for pledge and review and the Paris Agreement, this type of pressure might matter less than before, because it's built into the procedure that the contributions are nationally determined. Of course, by saying that it's less important than before doesn't mean that it's completely unimportant. There is still some kind of conditionality and in some of the offers. There's still some kind of peer pressure. But if you compare them to what was before, I think there's a remarkable difference, nevertheless.
As we speak, we have the next COP, COP28, on the horizon, and we will again go into this with hope. People will be talking about ambition, as they do every time that there is a COP. What are the best conditions, do you think, for us to achieve good results within the negotiations that will be happening at that negotiation?
Let me say, answer a bit more generally, like if you go forward, I think that we have to deal with this trade-off. I think that this trade-off is real, that you have that you can try to make a more ambitious agreement, but the problem is that then countries might opt out and a free ride. So this trade-off between big and broad, but also shallow versus deep and narrow is real. And we have to deal with this challenge. We need all countries, but also eventually we need deeper cuts. So I think that there are two ways we can try to achieve both. One possibility is that first you need a procedure so that you get a bigger coalition. So the Paris Agreement has succeeded with that. The next step would be to deepen the cuts and increase the ambition level without motivating countries to opt out, because it's possible. For example, Canada opted out of the Kyoto Protocol. No one can force a country to stick in the international agreement forever. So we have to increase the level of ambitions without making it attractive to move out. So that might mean that we must do it gradually. A second step is that we can find other means or other carrots, which makes it attractive to be inside the agreement or inside the coalition instead of being out. And there are not that many carrots. We are, of course, in a world with conflicts as we are in now, just the safety and security is one carrot. Like if you're part of a bigger club, maybe I feel safer than if I'm outside. I think there is a limit to that route. Another possibility is international trade. Trade is liberalized continuously, but it's still not free in the world. If something can allow me to get a bigger market access with more favorable trade conditions for my export, that can motivate me to do other things like cutting emissions. So by combining trade agreements and climate agreements, I think it might be possible to maintain a bigger coalition and deeper cuts at the same time.
We come back to the same problem again, though, don't we? That smaller economies trade less, and their trade is less important to larger economies.
A smaller country exports less than a bigger country, but relative to the economy, a smaller country is importing more as a fraction of the goods they are consuming on average, and they are exporting more of the production that they are producing as a fraction of the GDP. So it's very few countries who view international trade as being less important, especially in this context when we compare those gains from trade to the cost of pledging emission cuts.
The insights that you have into how you structure international negotiations, should they give comfort to some of the economies, particularly low-income economies now, who are becoming increasingly worried that these agreements do not bite hard enough and they will, of course, be exposed to the impacts of climate change quicker than wealthy economies?
Not necessarily. I think that at the current moment, we are not having enough progress to not worry about adaptation. So I think that one has to think about adaptation, because that's a solution. Adaptation is a strategy which is also possible to do unilaterally, even without having all countries in the world on board. And that typically might have a more immediate consequence than emission abatement. But of course, it's extremely important to realize that we cannot only adapt. We must reduce emission of fossil fuel. And that brings us to another problem of developing countries, because it might be more costly for them to hold back the economy. And it might be difficult for them to reduce emission in a situation where they should actually have economic growth so that they can reach a similar level eventually as the consumption level we have in the north. So the pledge and agree procedure is very flexible by allowing developing countries to decide nationally what the cuts should be. I think that for that to have nevertheless any bite, it's very important that you allow for trade in emission cuts. So once a country in the north and a country in the south has made some pledges and emission cut promise, then it must be possible to hold countries accountable to that. And second, it must be possible to exploit the gains from trade, in the sense that the North can allow itself to pollute more than its promise if in return it pays another country, say in the South, for the possibility to cut back emissions there while North is paying for that emission cut. So in that way, it's possible to motivate for emission cuts in a country in the South, even while having a country in the North paying for it. So this type of trade was possible in the Kyoto Protocol, and that is one of the things I think that the Paris Agreement is both permitting, but I think that to work on that to make it more effective and to make this market smoother is very important. It's very important in order to bring down the total cost of emission cuts in the world.
We look forward to deeper pledges and more extensive cuts in emissions. Let's hope that comes to pass. Bard, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tim.
If you want to find out more about the BREAD IGC course in environmental economics, go to the IGC website. It's at theigc.org. It's easy to find the information on the course. And also you can download the slides and reading list from Bard's talk. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts and our past episodes. As always, are at voxdev.org, where we also have articles about the papers we feature.